My father's brief appearance before the doors of the Regia seemed to me, to most of us, an abdication. He had made a formal plea, yet not even waited for a reply. "I cannot stop you," he had said to Turnus. It outraged me to think he had said that. How could he say it? How could he hand his power over to Turnus and creep back into the house? As I look back on it now, I think he was speaking not to Turnus, but to the crowd, the men, his Latins. They had, in fact, the power. Turnus could use them so long as they let him, but he could not control them any more than Latinus could. And so Latinus' plea was made to them, in the hope that they might remember it later. For now, they were afire, mad with excitement. The chance of a fight, the promise of bursting out in violence, vengeance, righteous wrath, that was all they saw at the moment, all they wanted. Every farmer hates a foreigner. And here was a troop of fancy fellows from somewhere who thought they could walk in and take over Latium, shoot the deer, marry the princess, push honest men around. Well, they'd find out their mistake. The old king wouldn't stand up against them, but the new one would. What did it matter if he was a Rutulian? We're all Latins. We stand shoulder to shoulder, the peoples of the West defending our fields, our altars, our women. Once we've driven these strangers into the sea, we can sort out our own affairs. Latinus had known the enthusiasm of war before, and knew better than to try to oppose its first furor, to waste speech on the mindless. But I was a child of peace, and all I could see was a defeated old man hiding in his palace, while fools bellowed in the street. And his queen, in her filthy slave's clothing, striding about, shameless, triumphing in the desecration of daily life, thinking she'd have it all her way. She wouldn't have me, not while I could get away from her. Even if my father had forsworn his power, he was my hope of resistance. I gathered up my things and told Maruna and a few other women to move with me out of the women's quarter into the royal apartments, the bedrooms my mother had not used for years. Lena and Sicana and all the rest of my mother's devoted attendants, the queen's faction, were already filtering back into the house. Gaia was brandishing her sword in the hallways. I was not going to let myself come again under the control of those women. Poor old Vestina was shocked, wept, whined, tried to order me to stay where I belonged, raged feebly when I refused, but I could not reassure her or take her with me. Her loyalty was too divided between Amata and myself. I slipped into the royal apartments through the back halls with my little troop and asked my father's guard to tell him that his daughter asked to occupy the queen's rooms. My father sent for me to come. He was sitting in the audience room with Drances and the others. Rather than ask them to leave, he rose and came to talk to me in the space behind the throne. He looked tired and grim, the wrinkles heavy on his cheeks and around his eyes.
"Why did you not consult me about this change of rooms, daughter?"
"I was afraid if she heard of it, the queen would forbid me."
"Do you not owe her obedience?"
"Not when obedience to her is disobedience to you." He frowned, turned half away, controlling anger.
"Say what you mean."
"If she can, if I'm in her power, she'll marry me to Turnus." He made an impatient, dismissive noise. That was why she took me up into the hills, to meet him there, to defy the oracle and betray the alliance you offered the Trojans.
"She would not," he began,
but he could not say.
"She would not dare."
Knowing she had opened the war gate, he stood scowling and indecisive. "Let me stay with you, father. Let me have one of your guards at my door. I'm trying to obey you and the oracle. I will not marry Turnus." After a while, he said,
"Do you dislike him so?"
His voice was weak. The question was weak. I tried to suppress my impatience. "You promised me to the Trojan leader. He is my husband. I will have no other."
"It looks as if the people will go to war to prevent it, daughter," he said,
with a show of making light of it. "Father, I know what I have to do, and I will. My mother won't stop me, and all the men in the kingdom shouting for war won't stop me. Only you can, I thought, but I did not say it. The thought, however, weakened my resolve, and my voice shook somewhat when I said, I beg you to let me do as I must, and protect me so that I can. I do not know what was going through his mind, what he might have said, when Drances came forward. He had, of course, heard us, and being always very sure of his mind and free with his tongue, and encouraged in his freedom, he did not even ask leave to break in on us. King, he said, your daughter is right, and wise, and brave. If Turnus were to take advantage of the queen's favor in this time of confusion, and defy the oracle, defy you, the crime could not be undone. Ruin would be upon us. Have patience. Our people will come to their senses. But as you said yourself, they must see what color blood is first. Keep the maiden safe with you, away from danger, away from the Rutulian. Let your guards defend her. She is our pledge of honor. In her, the sacred powers are with us. Drances always said too much, went too far, but maybe he had to rant now to make my father hear him.
Very well, Latinus said slowly, ponderously. You may stay in your mother's apartments, Lavinia. I will set a guard at the door. But I will have no more disrespectful, rebellious talk about the queen. You understand?
I bowed my head, murmured thanks, and slipped away. It was a great deal easier to talk with the king's guards than with the king. I had known them since I was a baby. Verus, Aulus, Albinus, Gaius, and the others. Some of them still called me by my childish title, Camilla, altar girl. The pick of Latinus' fighting men in his fighting years. They were all middle-aged, grizzled, a bit thick in the waist under their bronze corselets, fond of their food and drink, but not slow in their wits. They were keenly aware that the Regia was now a house divided. To my relief, I found that they shared my antipathy to Turnus, even if they did not want to think ill of their queen. The Rutulian's got the queen tied round his finger, said Verus, being her sister's son, see. She's made a son of him. He can't do wrong. It's how mothers are. I didn't mind how they explained it, so long as they saw that I might be in danger from Amata. And they did see that. For without my asking, one of them was near me wherever I went in the Regia to carry out my ritual and housekeeping duties. Those were strange days, when half my own house was foreign to me. I never entered the women's quarters, my home for so long. I was entirely estranged from my mother, and on terms of embarrassment with women I'd known all my life. Most of them could not believe I was insisting on my betrothal to the foreign chief, the enemy, or could not understand why I did. Amata let them say that I was mindlessly, slavishly obedient to my father, and whisper that he was quite senile. And indeed, hiding away in his quarters, eating in privacy, seeing almost no one, Latinus seemed to give proof of his weakness. I saw him only when I assisted him at a rite performed in the house or the city. He never went out the city gates. Neither did I, though I spent a good deal of time up on the roofs and the watchtower, looking out over the city walls. Up there, I could get away from the curiosity of some and the ill will of others. Verus or one of the other guards was always on duty at the foot of the stairs that led up to the platform in the southeast corner, the highest place in the city, from which you could see the exercise field, the plains and pastures and groves as far as Tyrus Farm, the blue hills eastward, and westward, the Lentulus winding down among its marshes to the dunes. I took my distaff and went up with Maruna or one of the other girls. We put up an awning, for the summer sun was getting hot. Sometimes women asked if they could join me and came to sit with me a while, with their work or their baby, as if things were as they used to be. It was brave of them, for it was a defiance of my mother, in whose power they were. Some of them told me about her behavior, which clearly worried them. Every day she ordered that the banquet hall be made ready, and animals butchered, so that Turnus and his ally chiefs could have a feast. But the chiefs were all busy riding about the countryside raising troops. And arrogant as he was, Turnus would hesitate to eat at the king's table without the king's invitation. He sent excuses. Amata always said, "He'll come tomorrow. We must be ready for him." So the house sweepers and the stable boys were living on choice cuts of beef and mutton, the women said, shaking their heads over the waste and folly of it. I felt safe up there on the tower. I watched the men drilling on the exercise field, practicing at sword play, grouping and charging as the officers shouted orders. It all seemed like the games boys play. Sometimes Verus or Aulis stood at the parapet with me and told me what the maneuvers were for.
"They're not using the trumpets," Verus remarked.
Latinus had told me once how he had realized, years ago in Etruria, that the Veians were telling each other across the battlefield where they needed reinforcements, when to attack or retreat, by the sweet piercing signals like bird calls. He captured two Etruscan trumpeters and had them teach their tricks to some of his boys. And he had won the advantage in more than one fight, he said, from those trumpet tunes. But Turnus was evidently not one for innovations or foreign ways. His men bellowed their orders. The endless, raucous shouting, like dogs barking, wore on all our nerves. The numbers of men encamped to the north and east of Laurentum grew daily. Ufens arrived with his rough Equians. An even rougher troop came from Praeneste. Men in wolfskin caps, who went into battle with one foot shod in leather and the other bare. From my platform I could see the captains conferring, among them my old suitors, Ufens and handsome Aventinus, flaunting his lionskin cape. Mezentius the Etruscan, who had been tyrant of Kyri, came up from Aerdia with his son Lausus. I looked at Mezentius to see what a traitorous, murderous tyrant looked like. I expected something more sinister than this tough old soldier, clearly very fond of the slender, dark-eyed son whom he kept close by him. Turnus was waiting for Messapus to come with his horse troops from Soracte. He arrived at last on the same day as a troop of Volscians, also mounted, black horsehair crests on their helmets. I looked for the woman warrior my poet had said would ride with the Volscians, but I did not see her. But then, he said he had invented her, but had he not invented all of us? I tried to take comfort in that, to pretend that it was all a pretense. All the shouted orders and clashed weapons and sharpened swords, the nervous horses and swaggering men, the horrible list of carnage my poet had told me on the last night. That was what they were making ready for. But why? What was it for? For a pet deer? For a girl? What good would that be? Without war, there are no heroes. What harm would that be? Oh, Lavinia, what a woman's question that is. They all gathered the next morning, our Latins nearest the city walls, then the Oscans, Sabines, Volscians in their bands, the Rutulians out front, and Turnus on his splendid stallion leading them. Women and children and old men on the city walls cheered and threw down flowers as they rode off north towards the river. My poet could tell how heads were split and brains spattered armor, how men with a sword in their lungs crawled gasping out their blood and life, how so-and-so killed so-and-so, and so on. He could tell what he had not seen with his mortal eyes, because that was his gift. But I do not have that gift. I can tell only what I was told and what I saw. What follows I was told, then and since, by men returned from the battle. Aeneas had gone upriver to the Greek settlement, hoping to bring reinforcements. He had been gone now for 8 days. The Trojans had had no word from him. They completed a steep ditch and earthwork round their camp, which was built into the bend of the river so that it was protected on two sides by the Tiber. Their ships were drawn up stern first on the beach within the earthwork. The forces of Latium attacked the camp. The older men among the Trojans, veterans of the 10-year siege of Troy, managed a fierce and skillful defense. Young Ascanius was wild to make a sally and chase the Latins off, but Aeneas had left orders that, if attacked, they were not to attack. The captains he left in charge followed those orders, though it was hard to restrain the young Trojans when the Latins began to taunt them as cowards, hiding behind their ramparts. "Is that all the Italian land you want?" they shouted. "That little bit of riverbank? Why don't you come out? We'll give you dirt to eat." They repeatedly tried to force the gate or swarm up over the rampart, but the Trojans drove them back, hand to hand and with showers of darts and javelins. A rain of iron, Rufus Anso called it. We women of the Regia took in as many wounded as we could and looked after them as best we could. Rufus Anso was a farmer from the royal lands just west of the city, who was brought back to the city wounded. He was about my age. A javelin had gone right through his belly below the navel. They had pulled it on out from the back. Our healing women told me he would die. He was not in much pain yet, only frightened. He wanted to talk, not to be left alone, and I sat with him that night. I had sent for his mother, but she could not come till the next day. He said, "The air went dark all at once, like rain. It was like a rain of iron." A dart had hit his arm near the elbow, and he complained more of the pain of that small wound than the other. He seemed incredulous that he had been hurt at all. He thought it unfair, bad luck. I wondered why a man would go into battle expecting not to be hurt, what he thought a battle was. He was impressed by the Trojan defense and said they were good fighters, but he had expected to kill, not to be killed, and lay puzzling about the injustice of it. His mother came next day, and he was carried off home, where he died in agony a few days later. What weapons did to men was all I saw then of warfare. I did not have to watch them fighting yet. A report came back to us just after dark. While his men made a showy attack on the gate of the Trojan camp, Turnus alone got round the ramparts on the riverside, lighted a torch, and ran from one beached ship to the next, firing them. The dry wood was caulked with resin, and the ships lay close side by side. The fire caught. The downriver wind spread it from ship to ship. In no time, they were all aflame. Turnus escaped before the Trojans saw the fire towering up over the river at their back. All they could do was cut the lines, push the mass of flaming ships out into the water, and watch them drift out on the current and lurch and burn down to the waterline and sink. Rufus Anso listened to the man who reported this to us and said, "Well, seems they won't be going back where they came from, those Trojans." He thought it a good joke, and there was much cheering and high spirits among the wounded men and the women of the Regia. I was confused and troubled. Should I not be happy at this feat of daring, this victory for my people? Here, among my own people, caring for men of my own people hurt by the invaders, how could I be on the invaders' side? But if our purpose was to drive the foreigners out of Italy, why burn their ships? Evidently, Turnus meant to exterminate them, not drive them away. If he had acted with any intention except to do immediate harm and carry off an act of bravery, I thought again and again of the treaty Latius had made with them, which we had violated. Tyrus and the herdsmen had attacked in anger. The Trojans had responded in self-defense. The matter could and should have stopped there. If there is any sacred thing, it is a treaty. How could the powers of our earth, our land, be with us if we not only defied the oracle they gave us, but did one of the great acts of evil, the deliberate breaking of a promise? My mind went round and round on these thoughts, and my heart was torn and miserable, wanting to rejoice with the people around me, but unable to. I felt myself a traitor, as if I had done the great wrong, had caused it simply by being who and what I was. My mother had taught me that self-pitying guilt, and I had known it most of my life. Though I fought against it, knowing it childish and mistaken, under this stress and pressure, it was all too easy to be childish, to be mistaken, to drop back into it. The few men who came back to Laurentum later in the evening said our army had set sentinels around the enemy camp and settled down to feasting and drinking, content with their day's work and ready to break into the camp next morning and finish off the Trojans. So then, if Turnus had a plan, it was extermination. I know what happened that night from tales told next day by men coming back into the city, and then much later by Seristus, the Trojan, when he became my friend. He took part in a grim conference in the Trojan camp that evening about their chances of holding out until Aeneas returned with the hoped-for allies, not knowing he had gone from Palantium to Etruria. They were desperately anxious about his long absence. Two soldiers, young Euryalus and his older friend Nisus, came to the conference and volunteered to creep out through the Latin encampment and carry word to Aeneas. Distressed over the loss of the ships, craving his father's presence and support, Ascanius sent the pair out heaped with praise and promises. When Aeneas came back and won the war, he said, Euryalus would receive all the lands belonging to King Latinus as a reward, and 12 Latin matrons to use as he pleased. I remember the wave of pure rage that came over me when Seristus told me that. So the two sneaked over the ramparts in the deep dark of night and threaded among the burnt-out watchfires, finding their enemies sprawled asleep, full of food and wine. Instead of hurrying through the Latin camp and on upriver, they fell to slaughtering sleeping men and stealing their drinking cups and armor. They cut the throats of 10 or 20 helpless drunken men before their bloodlust and greed were sated, and they finally hurried off, burdened with stolen stuff. A patrol saw the gleam of stolen armor, heard the clinking of it, fell on them and killed them. Their heads were cut off, stuck on poles, and paraded in front of the Trojan ramparts at dawn. When Sylvia and I hid and spied on the Trojans, we saw Euryalus on the grass, joking with Ascanius. Gorgeous, Sylvia had called him. We had seen his mother straighten the red cap on his head. She was the woman who offered Aeneas a weaving she brought from Troy for her son's bride gift. She saw the heads on the poles. Later in the morning, the Italian troops made an all-out assault. Against heavy odds, the Trojans held on. Their archers shot Rutulians and Equians dead as they worked their way through the ditch, and their swordsmen met attackers clambering up over the earthworks, sword to sword, and repelled them. The Trojans fought so well that by noon, half our army had fallen back, unwilling to charge that ditch and wall again. They fought so well that some young Trojans, sick of being on the defensive, began to shout victory and opened the gates of their camp to charge out and drive the enemy back. Turnus, utterly fearless, hacked and hewed his way in that opened gate, not even looking to see if his men were following him. Alone, he cut his way through the enemy camp, so mad with the fury of killing that the Trojans ran from him till he got down to the river. He leapt in full armor as he was, swam downstream, and came ashore among his friends. That feat of reckless courage was the last of the day. Both armies were worn out. There were no more assaults. Both camps were silent that evening. We got news all day and in the evening, little by little, as wounded men were brought or made their way back to Laurentum. They were still limping in after dark. Some of them were not wounded, only tired or frightened. They had left the siege, left the battle. They wanted no more fighting just now. These were Latins whose homes were in or near the city, whose relatives would take them in. No Rutulians, no Equians or Volscians were among them. One of our royal herdsmen, Urso, came with a sword wound in his thigh. I asked him about Tyrus and his sons, Sylvia's two remaining brothers. He said they had all been in the fighting, both days, and that the old man was like a wild boar, mad with rage. But he wore out, he said. Urso was not a man I had known well, and he did not even recognize me until one of the other women called me by name. Then he stared at me, and his face flushed and broke out in sweat. He raised himself up on his elbow. It's all about you, woman, he said. Why wouldn't you marry our Aelmo, or that King Turnus? All this killing for a girl's whim. The women hurried over and hushed him and hissed at him, scandalized, but I said, let him alone. He had to fight for me. My voice shook, and the fierce red blush of shame and anger ran over my face and body as I spoke. I'm doing what I have to do, Urso. I told him. We all are. He lay staring at me, but said no more. We had turned the courtyard into an infirmary. It was full of wounded men by now, and women looking after them, in a murmur of low voices and moaning, and the glimmer of oil lamps in the warm night under the restless leaves of the great laurel. The women's quarter remained closed, and my mother stayed there. She gave orders for supplies when asked, but she had not come out of her rooms all day. Early the next morning, long before sunrise, I saw her striding under the colonnade to the royal apartment, alone. Verus, on duty at that door, bowed his head to her. She went in. I got up from my half-sleeping vigil beside a dying man and followed her. I do not know why. Maybe I thought I should defend my father from her. As I came down the corridor, I heard her voice in his room, coaxing at first, then becoming hard and fierce. "It's not too late, Latinus," she was saying. "The foreigners will be destroyed today. They can't hold out any longer. Their great chieftain has run away up the river. He won't be back. Send to Turnus. Tell him he is your son, your daughter's husband. Put the reins of power in his hand." "Why not? You've given up your power. So why are you delaying? Why are you hiding in the Regia? You could have gone out and watched the battle at least. You could have taken a little of the credit for saving the country. Have you been hiding here thinking the foreigners would come and rescue you and Lavinia? Did you really think they were going to defeat Turnus?" She said the name Turnus with passionate energy. I stood in the dark corridor just past the door. Inside the bedroom it must have been even darker.
"What is it you want, Amata?"
My father's voice was thick with sleep, low and slow.
"What do you think you want?"
"I want you to save a little of our pride. It is shameful that Turnus would have to be ashamed of his father-in-law. Get up and go out there. Act like a king."
"What am I to do?"
I did feel shame, hearing that.
"Act like a man for once, if you can't act like a king. If you want to know how a king acts, look at Turnus."
There was a silence, then a sound of movement, a shift or scuffle in the dark room, a sharp, "Ah!" from my mother.
"Enough,"
my father said, even lower, but with a different tone.
"Enough of Turnus. He is not my son or yours. He is not Lavinia's husband or yours. Go back to your rooms now. Keep silent. Do not send any more messengers to Turnus. My men have intercepted them. Even if the Trojans are defeated, that will not make Turnus king of Latium. I will never make him king of Latium, nor will you. Now go."
He must have been holding her, and now pushed her out of his room. She came out, staggering wildly, and nearly fell. She turned back to the doorway at once. But he menaced her in some way, for she stopped and stood clenching her fists and shaking them in front of her shoulders, crying out broken words I could not understand. She whirled round with a strange moan, like a hurt dog, and ran back down the corridor. She had not seen me standing just past the door. I was trembling so that I could hardly move, but I managed to creep on past the dark doorway of the room and follow my mother back to the courtyard full of hurt and dying men, where the paling sky dimmed the light of the small lamps.
"The worst moment?"
Aeneas ponders for a while.
"The worst moment was coming up the river in the Etruscan ships. My few men and the Greeks Evander had sent with me, and the Etruscans from Kyri. I was counting on getting up to our camp at sunrise. I had no idea what had been going on, of course, but I was worried. Young Pallas had been hanging around me all night, talking, asking questions. King Evander's son."
"I knew him when we were children," I said. "He took me to the wolf's den near Palantium."
"He was a very nice boy, very excited the night before his first battle. Poor boy. Poor Evander. Well, Pallas kept chattering, but the feeling that something was wrong kept growing on me. We came over the bar into the river, as the air began to get gray. I saw stuff floating downstream all around us. Driftwood, I thought, from a storm higher up the river. But it was all black. A big chunk bumped up against our prow. It was the stern of a ship, charred, eaten away by fire. The river was full of pieces of burned ships floating along with the current. Tarkon and Aester from Kiri came up beside me, and Aester asked after a while, "Are they yours?" I said yes. I had seen the figurehead of the Ida go by. Makatis was with me there, and after a while he said, "It must be the whole fleet." I thought so too. I said, "No bodies." For there was nothing but the fragments of the ships. But that was no cheer. It looked as if they'd taken our camp, burned the ships, slaughtered the people. I said to Tarkon, "I fear I've brought you to a lost battle." But he shook his head. "Wait and see," he said. "The Etruscans are strange people. They seem to live half in the other world." So we put on armor in case of arrows from shore when we landed, and we rode up on the river thick with broken, burnt wood. You could smell the stink of burning. We rounded the long curve just as the sun rose. I saw our fort, our camp. The ships were gone, but the earthworks were standing, and there were men on them, guards, in Trojan helmets. My heart gave a leap, and I held up my shield as high as I could and shouted out to my people in the camp. The first sunlight struck the bronze in a great flare of light, and the men on shore shouted back, first the guards, then a roar from them all. They weren't dead. They weren't asleep. They were ready. After that, I never really worried much about the outcome of it all. I remember Aeneas' words as I remember the poet's words. I remember every word because they are the fabric of my life, the warp I am woven on. All my life since Aeneas' death might seem a weaving torn out of the loom unfinished, a shapeless tangle of threads making nothing, but it is not so. For my mind returns as the shuttle returns, always to the starting place, finding the pattern, going on with it. I was a spinner, not a weaver, but I have learned to weave. My judgment of Turnus is that he could not look farther than the moment. His response to emergency was instant, active, complete. Where he failed and wavered was in following through, holding to a purpose. That, of course, is where Aeneas excelled. In emergency, at the moment of choice, Aeneas might hesitate, confused, looking to the outcome, torn between conflicting claims and possibilities. In a torment of indecision, he groped for his purpose, his fate, till he found it. Then his choice was made, and he acted on it. And while he acted, his purpose was unwavering. Afterwards, he might agonize over it all again, question his conscience endlessly, never fully satisfied that he had done the right thing. But Turnus never looked back, as he never looked forward. I think he was truly fearless. But a man without fear is one who lacks a quality of humanity. Men followed him for his brilliant daring, but he did not take charge of them. He met the event as it came, and so events buffeted him and blew him about, and he lost sight of what had to be done, and seemed to act on whim. So he broke a treaty twice without a thought. So more than once he left the battlefield, abandoned his men without guidance, and at last, when he had to face the implacable, he seemed to act in a kind of panic. But it was not fear even then. It was recklessness meeting the reckoning. Aeneas, who does not forgive himself, will not grant me even this tempered judgment. He will say of Turnus only, "He was young." At any rate, Turnus certainly could rise to the unforeseen. He pulled his Rutulians and their allies together at the first sight of the Etruscan ships sweeping up the river in the sunrise, and was ready with a fighting force to meet Aeneas and his allies as they landed. Some of the ships could land within the Trojan earthwork, but the current brought others to shore outside it, and the men disembarking were at a great disadvantage
as Turnus' men attacked them. Archers and lancemen on the ships covered them with the iron rain, and the Trojans sallied out of their camp to defend them. Many Italians, Trojans, Greeks, Etruscans never saw the noon of that morning, and the killing went on and on. Up the riverbank they fought, and over the green lawns, and through the thickets of the shore. The Trojans were tremendously heartened by their leader's return, and Aeneas had to keep them from wild charges that would scatter them out, since even with the new reinforcements, they were far outnumbered. He kept them, Seristus told me, in good defensive order around their camp and the Etruscan ships, so they had a fallback if they needed it. And the battle went on in the heat of the June day, hour after hour, man against man. Turnus was enraged with Evander for allying with the Trojans against him. When he saw Evander's son Pallas dueling with young Lausus, he saw a chance of vengeance. He shouted out that this was his fight, and made Lausus stand back. Pallas made a brave attempt to fight, but Turnus killed him with one awful blow of his bronze-pointed oak spear through his shield and through his body. Then he stood over him.
"Send him back to his traitor father the way he deserves to get him," he said.
And putting his foot on the dying boy, he yanked with main force at the heavy gold-plated weapon belt across his shoulder till he tore it off. And he strode off with the trophy, waving it in the air and laughing. When Aeneas heard of this, the fury came into him. He told Seristus to keep the Trojans together and went looking for Turnus. He killed men along the way, left and right, ruthless, relentless. He was the mad dog among the sheep now. The Latins fell back from him as the Trojans had fallen back from Turnus in the camp. But Turnus himself was nowhere. After killing Pallas, he disappeared. No man I ever talked to knew what became of him during the long hour that Aeneas stalked him through the battlefield, challenging him, calling out to him to come fight. No doubt he was resting, catching his breath somewhere up the hill in the shade, but he chose a strange time to do it. It was Mezentius, the old Etruscan tyrant, who met Aeneas face to face. Men who saw it said the two fought as equals. When Aeneas wounded the older man in the thigh with a spear, Mezentius' men gathered round him and got him mounted on a horse, while his son Lausus covered their retreat. Young as he was, Lausus came bravely at Aeneas. After shouting in vain at him not to try to attack, Aeneas killed him with a single sword stroke. Then he followed Mezentius to the riverbank. When they told him his son was dead, the old tyrant turned and called out to Aeneas, "Come on, then! What does my death matter now?" and charged. Aeneas had to kill the horse with a blow between the eyes. Wounded, pinned under the fallen horse, the old man fought like a bear until Aeneas cut his throat. Many Italians who saw that fight asked why it was Mezentius, not Turnus, fighting the Trojan captain. The fury went out of Aeneas then. He went back to where Pallas lay and gave orders, in tears, that the boy's body be wrapped to carry back to his father, Evander, with a guard of honor, though not with slaves to be sacrificed, as the poet said. I do not know how my poet could think his own Italian people would commit such barbarity. Perhaps the Greeks might. Though all my poet sang was true and is true, yet there are small mistakes in the truth of it, and I have tried to mend those tiny rents in the great fabric as I tell my part in it. So then, Aeneas withdrew his men from the field. The Italians were already withdrawing, not to their siege position round the Trojan camp, but miles farther back towards the city. Laurentum itself was full of wounded men and refugees now, and more kept straggling in. Everywhere was a sense of exhaustion, confusion, lack of purpose. But when Turnus came, he appeared unaware of any such mood. He rode in the city gate on his fine stallion, tossed the reins to a stableman in the street before the Regia, and strode in, handsome and smiling, broad and erect in his high-crested helmet, Pallas' ornate gold sword belt glittering over his shoulder. I watched him arrive with Messapus and Tolumnius, the Rutulian soothsayer, from my watchtower. Soon I saw my mother hurry across the courtyard to the reception rooms, picking her way round the makeshift beds of wounded men. I went downstairs then, My father was not in his apartments, so he had come out of hiding and gone to meet Turnus and the other captains. I was glad of that. There was a lot to be done for the people in the Regia, and I was busy with that all the evening, till Drancy's found me at the granary room. Now, I had never much liked Drancy's. He was not like the old farmer warriors who made up most of my father's circle of friends and counselors. He was soft, flexible, enthusiastic. He did not lay down his opinion like a large rock on the table as they did, and challenge anybody to move them from it. His opinion seemed to weigh very little, to be light and airy, a mere waft of words. But he got his way more often than not. He was a city man, a politician. To him, my mother and I were unimportant persons in tactically important positions. We had to be managed. He saw women as he saw dogs or cattle, members of another species, to be taken into account only as they were useful or dangerous. He considered my mother dangerous, me negligible, except insofar as I might be made use of. Yet he had an acute perception of relationships, more like that of a woman than of many men. He knew I was afraid of Amata, that I had run away from her and taken refuge in the royal apartments, that she was in love with Turnus, that I was not, that my father and she had quarreled. All this was grist to his mill. He had always opposed betrothing me to Turnus, I suppose because he saw Turnus as a threat to Latina's power encouraged by Amata's favoritism, and was envious of Turnus' splendid, contemptuous manhood, and wanted to thwart it. As I came out of the granary, he stopped me and said, out of hearing of anyone else, "Daughter of Latinus, have no fear that your father will let you be given to the Rutulian. Our king could not prevent the breaking of the treaty, but no sacrilegious marriage will follow, be assured. Trust me." I thanked him and stood with lowered eyes. I knew what he thought of me, the girl who understood nothing, the nobody that everybody was fighting a war about. All the same, I was grateful to him for saying what he did. Though the war had not gone as they expected, and many of them were troubled about the broken treaty and the flouted oracle, still most of our people backed their queen and her local hero against the foreigners, and they assumed that whatever my parents chose was my choice. My father's weakness had left me alone, isolated. There was nobody I could tell the truth to, nobody to hear me speak my heart. Maruna was loyal beyond question, but I could not lay my burden on the shoulders of the powerless. She knew my heart, but we could not talk freely. The next morning, Latina sent messengers to the Trojan camp requesting a truce for the performance of rites and the burial of the dead. Corpses were lying all over the river bank and the ground for a mile inland. Drances was one of the messengers, and when he came back to Laurentum, he made a point of seeing me and telling me about the parley. He said, "We told the Trojan leader that since he surely had no quarrel with the dead, would he not allow decent burial to men who might have been the hosts, the fathers-in-law of his men?" He answered at once, very directly, "You ask peace for the dead. I would grant it to the living if I could. Why are we at war? If Turnus will not honor his king's treaty, if he wants to drive us out of Latium, then let him alone meet me alone with sword in hand. We too could have spared all these deaths." Ah, you should have seen him as he said that. What a man he is, the man you're promised to. I have seen him. That brought Drances up short. He stared. "I spied on the Trojan camp from the hill, the day after they landed," I said. "Aeneas is a tall man, with a deep chest and big hands. He speaks rather softly. His eyes are full of fire, smoke and fire, because he saw his city burn." Drances continued to stare. The dog had talked. "You speak the truth, king's daughter," he said at last. I looked down at my spindle and let it drop, twisting the wool into thread as it fell. "Please go on telling me about the parley." Drances pulled himself together and went on. He had thanked Aeneas, he said, and promised to revive the treaty with Latinus. I told him, "Let Turnus seek his own alliances. We would rather help you rebuild your Troy here, with us, and so we made a 12-day truce. And now the Trojan knows that Turnus is still not the ruler of Latium. It was a good day's work. I doubt our people will go back to war, whatever Turnus and Messapus decide to do.
That is for the king to decide, I murmured.
Indeed, indeed. But take heart, Lavinia. Your father will never defy the oracle.
He presumed too much, I thought. I bowed slightly and walked away from him. He might pat the dog, but it declined to wag its tail.
From the farms and from the city, people went out that afternoon and found their sons and fathers and brothers dead on the field. Some carried home the bodies of their dead to wash them and mourn them and bury them. Others made pyres there where they fell, so that evening all the fields north of Laurentum were clustered with fires, and smoke dimmed the stars. All the woodsmen in Latium brought wood in from the forests, and next day a huge common pyre was built outside the city walls for men who lived too far to be carried home for burial. It burned all day. Grief hung as dark and heavy in the city as the smoke. We were told that the Trojans were burning their dead on the shore of the river. Those who saw the ceremony said that young men ran round the pyre 3 times on foot, then horsemen galloped round it 3 times, while people wailed aloud and blew conch shells. Warriors threw the weapons they had taken from their enemies onto the fire that consumed their friends. The rite was not like ours, and yet it was like enough. There was nothing alien in it. The next days passed in a curious suspense and inactivity. We looked after wounded men in the Regia and in houses all over Laurentum. Some healed, some died. No word came from the Trojans. Evidently, they were waiting to hear what we would say to Aeneas' offer of single combat with Turnus and a restoration of the treaty. But my father sent no messengers to them. Like his people, he was uncertain what to do. Drances had made sure that Aeneas' words to him were heard everywhere, and many people, in the anger of their grief, cried that this war was accursed. It was Turnus' fault. He had broken the truce Latinus made. If Turnus claimed the king's daughter, let him win her fighting the Trojan hand to hand. Let one life pay for all. But there were as many who, fearing foreigners, said that the war was our salvation, that the Trojans and their allies had come to overturn the land, and Latinus could save Latium only by sending Turnus with our forces to destroy or drive out the invaders. When Latinus at last called his counselors, they came in that same division of mind, and they were met right away with bad news from Diomedes, the Greek who had founded a city in the south, whom we had sent to for troops. He refused. He politely told our envoys that we were fools to take on the Trojans.
"We fought them for 10 years, he said, "and though we beat them, how many of us ever came home? Our victory brought us shipwreck, death, exile. Aeneas is no ordinary man. He brings his gods with him. Keep the peace. Keep your treaty with him. Sheathe your swords."
Amata and I were at that meeting, sitting far back in the shadows behind Latinus' throne, and veiled. With us was the princess Juturna, Turnus' sister, who had come up from Aridia to be with him. She was very beautiful, with blue eyes like his, but hers were strange eyes that seemed to gaze through water at the world. She had vowed chastity, people said. Some said it was because the river Juturna, for which she was named, gave her certain powers so long as she remained virgin. Others said she had been raped as a girl, and since then would speak to no man but her brother. I do not know the truth of these stories. She spoke to us only in the barest civility, very softly, calling Amata aunt and me cousin, and sat listening to the council, a translucent gray veil over her head and shoulders. When the Greek's messenger was done, the counselors broke into muttering, and then discussion, and they would have been shouting soon, but the king stood up and lifted his arms, slowly, with open palms upturned, in the gesture of invocation. They fell still. Latinus bowed his head, and the silence deepened. He sat down on his high seat again and spoke.
I wish we had settled this great matter sooner. Better not to convene the council when the enemy is at the gate. My people, we are fighting an unrighteous war against an enemy who will not be conquered, because they follow the will of earth and heaven while we do not. We have broken our obligations. They have held to theirs. We cannot defeat them. I know my mind has wavered on this, but I am certain now. Hear what I propose. Let us give them the land I own out beyond Sicania, all the rough foothill farmland there, and the pine forests of the mountains. Let us ask them to build their city there and share our realm. Or, if they wish to leave, we will rebuild the ships we burned. Let us send them envoys with gifts to seal the treaty now. Consider well what I say, and take this chance to spare our shaken people from defeat.
Silence followed, but not a cold silence. They knew their king was a brave man, a warrior who would not surrender lightly, and a man of piety who had received the clear word of an oracle and held that it must be obeyed. They were thinking it over. Unfortunately, Drances got up and began to talk. He talked vividly and fluently, as always, but with burning malevolence, addressing Turnus directly. He told Turnus the war was his doing, the defeat was his doing, and it was up to him to end it, unless he was so smitten with glory and so lustful for the dowry of a king's daughter that he would lead our armies out again, leaving our worthless lives scattered over the fields, unburied, unwept, unknown. But if you had any real courage at all, you'd stand up to the man who challenged you. At this, Turnus, of course, burst out and called Drances a coward, who had never yet been on the battlefield, whose tongue talked of courage while his feet were running away. The Latin alliance was not defeated, far from it. Had not the Tiber run red with Trojan blood? Maybe the Greek Diomedes was afraid of Aeneas, but Messapus was not, and Tolumnius was not, and the Volscians did not know what fear was. And does this hero challenge me to fight him alone? I hope he does. Better that I appease the angry powers by my death, or win deathless fame by my courage. Better I than Drances. There was a growl of applause for that from the old counselors, but Latinus intervened to stop the exchange of boast and insult, and was about to speak again, when a messenger ran in under Verus' escort, shouting, "The Trojan army is advancing on the city!" He was followed by other messengers, and through the open doors of the room by a great noise of people in alarm, like a flock of geese or swans startled up, crying and cackling on the marshes. Turnus seized the moment, unhesitating.
"To arms!" he shouted. "Shall we sit here praising peace while the enemy attacks us?"
And he ran out, calling to his captains, ordering who should defend the city and who should ride out with him. Latinus could not have stopped him if he had tried. He did not try. He sat motionless on his throne while the council broke up and the counselors hurried out to see what was happening. Drances tried to talk to him, but Latinus paid no attention, ordering him with a gesture to stand away. At last he got up and walked past us women, going to his apartment. He did not look at us or speak. Amata took my hand. Without thought, as if her touch were ice or fire, I pulled my hand away from her and stood facing her, ready to fight or run if she tried to touch me again. She stood staring at me. "I won't hurt you," she said at last, almost childishly. "You have hurt me enough," I said. "What do you want?" She spoke hesitantly, still staring at me as if she scarcely knew me.
I think we should show ourselves to the people, at the altar of the Lar Popularis."
She was right. With the king in hiding and the enemy attacking, the people needed immediate reassurance that all was well with their royal family and the powers that guarded the city. I nodded. I set off, then turned, and said to Juturna, "You come too." I had no business giving orders to a king's sister, but she came without a word, pulling her gray veil about her. We went out and walked through the streets to the square where the shrine to the protective spirit of the city stands. As we walked, women joined us, coming out of every house, running down the streets. When we came to the place, there was a great crowd around us. Amata had walked ahead, and she lighted the incense, but it was I who had stood with the king before this altar 100 times, and it was I who knew and spoke the words he used to speak, offering the people's duty and honor to the Lar, the spirit and indwelling power of border and boundary, walled city, place of our people. The women around us bowed their heads or knelt down, and the people crowded into the streets and up on the walls and roofs fell silent, listening. I felt flow into me from them a loving trustfulness, a flood of feeling that humbled my mind and yet gave me a sense of great and reliable support. I was their daughter, their pledge to the future, a powerless girl, yet one who could speak for them to the great powers, a mere token for political barter, yet also a sign of what was of true value to us all. I stood among my people in silence when the ritual was done, all of us quiet as the birds that stand in hundreds at evening on the sea beach, seeming to worship together. And so we could hear the noise outside the walls, rumble and clash and crash, neighing and yelling, and thunder of hooves and feet. The noise of an army making ready for war.